I'm going to have a conversation today with Holmes Morton, an ex-boilerman in the U.S. Merchant Marine and an amateur cellist who became interested in neurobiology, and that led him to Harvard Medical School and a pediatric residency at Boston Children's Hospital, followed by research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. In 1988, a urinalysis he was doing from a child with late and rapid onset of symptoms that resembled cerebral palsy revealed glutaric aciduria, a genetically caused enzyme deficiency that results in the accumulation of glutaric acid in the brain and other organs. That disease and other similar inborn errors of metabolism, to use Victor McCusick's classic phrase, are so rare and so poorly understood that they were not thought to be preventable or treatable. Since that fateful day, however, Holmes Morton has worked quietly and tirelessly in Lancaster County among the Amish in a clinic he developed from the ground up, the Clinic for Special Children. He and his colleagues are now recognized worldwide as pioneers in genomic medicine, and we're proud to have him on the staff at Lancaster General Hospital. But I'm sitting with him today in that same clinic to talk about his work and its promise. His origins in West Virginia are still audible in his speech, but those hills and those people are not so far away from the rural fields of Lancaster County. Holmes, I'd like to start with some practical questions just to give our listeners an idea of what goes on here in this world-famous clinic in the heart of the Lancaster County Amish countryside. How many people work here? What do they do? I mean, what activities are they engaged in?
Well, the clinic has grown from a staff of three in 1989 when we first came to Lancaster County to a staff of 10. There are two full-time pediatricians, Kevin Strauss and myself. We have two people working in our diagnostic lab, Eric Puffenberger, who's a molecular biologist and population geneticist, and most recently, Roy Martin, who has joined the lab to do some analytical work to help Eric out. We also have an older Amish person, Rebecca Hoyard, now Rebecca Smoker, who joined us back in 1988 and 89 and has really been instrumental in our interrelationship with the Amish community. I like to say that Becca speaks Dutch when Dutch needs to be spoken.
She's sort of your liaison and outreach?
She's an important liaison, and her family had, her extended family had several children with glutaric aciduria who had been disabled and some had died, so she was very interested in the goals of the clinic, which were to understand that disease and learn to treat it. So Rebecca's been with us from the start. We stole two nurses from Lancaster General to help us out. One, Donna Robinson, has her not only RN experience at Lancaster General, which lasted about 12 or 14 years, but has a nurse practitioner's license to do intensive care work from the University of Pennsylvania, and joined us really to help with in-hospital protocols for managing these sick children. And Christine Hendrickson, who joined us a couple years ago, who also is an RN and helps with immunizations and helps move patients through the clinic. So the staff has included those individuals, and then my wife, who was the co-founder of the clinic, has always managed the business aspect of the clinic, which is a small nonprofit organization. We have annual audits, which are necessary to maintain that status. We have to raise funds to underwrite about two-thirds of the cost of the clinic.
How do you raise funds for the clinic?
Well, the budget, like the staff, has grown considerably since 1989, and now we have about a $1.3 million a year operating cost, which sounds big to me. It's not necessarily big to Lancaster General, but it sounds big to me. And a third of that cost comes directly from fundraisers by the community. The Amish and Mennonite communities now have four auctions a year, the largest of which is in the Loyola area, the Loyola Produce Auction, and is held always the third Saturday of September, and this will be the 16th year that they have done fundraising. And they, in one day at that auction, raise about one-third of our annual operating budget, which at the end of the day is given to us in large sacks, and we go down and put it in the bank, invest that in Vanguard, and draw off of that as we need to. The indirect cost for that fundraiser is about 4%. So it's a very efficient way to raise money, and that income underwrites the cost of operating the clinic. About a third of our budget comes from fees, directly for clinic visits, which are inexpensive, for laboratory testing, which includes sequencing of genes to identify mutations that we do for $50 a piece and would cost you much more elsewhere. And so the income from the lab has been another important source of income for us, both here locally, and we are a reference lab for sequencing certain genes for other medical centers throughout the United States and really throughout the world. We're listed on Gene Test to do sequencing for specific genes that we're familiar with and that other people need to have sequenced from time to time.
So it's a digression, but let me ask you to digress a minute, because once we talk about gene sequencing, we're talking about expensive, specialized equipment. Mm-hmm. And obviously implicit in what you're saying is that you have some very high-powered equipment here. And that, of course, not only means that you are able to do tests and generate revenue, but you have to buy those machines.
Yes.
What? How much of an investment are we talking about?
Well, when the clinic started, we had the good fortune to have David Packard, who was one of the founders of Hewlett-Packard, give us a GC mass spec, a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer that we used to do screening for glutaric aciduria, and that sort of initiated our high-tech lab, and that was about an $80,000 gift at the time. The Mennonite Church, once the clinic was established, bought our amino acid analyzer, which was about a $50,000 instrument, and with that instrument we were able to decrease the cost of amino acid analysis for maple syrup disease from $450 to $50. So that we got a good lab to start with because we had some nice donations that helped us start. And the intention of the clinic has always been to be able to diagnose these diseases and monitor them very efficiently, because we think that's the best way to learn to treat the disorders and to change long-term outcome. We have an ABI sequencer, which we bought for about $50,000 to do our gene testing. That money was actually in a reserve account to replace the mass spectrometer, and about 10 years after the clinic was founded, the Hewlett-Packard Foundation gave us a new mass spectrometer, so we saved that money and we bought an ABI sequencer for Eric to do our gene testing here at the clinic. And then more recently, we have begun to use a technology called SNP genotypes to look for new disorders that cause the genetic diseases that we treat. And a company by the name of Affymetrics, because they were impressed with the work we were doing with their technology, recently donated that piece of equipment, which is a couple hundred thousand dollar piece of genotyping equipment that we use to, again, for diagnostic testing to find causes of these disorders. So the laboratory has always been an integral part of our practice, and I say for us here, when a child comes through the door and has the parents have concern about why the child is not thriving or why the child is not developing, then we approach that clinical case on the one hand by looking at them physically to see if we can recognize a genetic syndrome. We pull out their stethoscope and listen to their heart. And at the same time, we will move from stethoscope to biochemical testing to genetic testing, all sort of in the same sequence, if that seems to be the most reasonable way to get to the basis of the problem.
Well, working in sequence would probably be a good thing for you to do, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I think it is, you know, it has always been an important philosophy of the clinic, is that we work as general pediatricians to provide care for children who have complex problems. And we've always felt that the best way to learn to treat those problems is to understand the basis of the problem, the origin of the problem, and we use modern testing to get to that. And whatever we have to use to get to the basis of the disorder that we're working with, we try to make available, not only available in the sense that it's physically here, but also available in the sense it's affordable by people who can't always afford very expensive testing.
Well, I think the theme that I would draw out of what you just said is, first of all, I know you always like to say that I'm a pediatrician, basically. And so you're a pediatrician plus, in a sense, that you start with your understanding of the patient from your perspective as a pediatrician, but you're able to offer much more technologically oriented insight and technologically guided therapy.
That's true. And that, you know, I think it's important that we've always integrated the general care of the children who come here with an understanding of the natural history of the disease, of the force of the genetic disorder upon their life. And we not only work with a group of children who have lethal disorders, and they, you know, require recognition and care. They get ear infections too during the year or so they survive, and we provide care for that group of children and like to diagnose them efficiently and explain to the parents what we know and what we don't know and what we might learn that would help in the future. And we work with a group of children who have highly treatable genetic disorders that really should cause no morbidity and mortality if they're recognized in a timely way and treated. So we really, you know, look at the full gamut of genetic diseases, and as pediatricians say, you know, how can we understand this disease? And we often have to accept the fact there's a limited amount we can do, as all physicians do. And at the same time, we are very optimistic that with a better understanding of many of these diseases, the therapies are no more complex or amazing than good therapies that other physicians provide for common acquired diseases.
Pneumonia is pretty complex and amazing if you don't have antibiotics.
That's right.
But that leads me then to ask you how the clinic functions on a daily basis. How do people come to you, and what is the week like around here?
Well, there's always somebody on call 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and that's sort of one of our operating principles, is that we are providing care for these children in the outpatient setting, where we see them for ear infections and vomiting and diarrhea, and if their heart failure worsens or their seizure disorder worsens, then we're available to see them in the outpatient setting, and we reserve afternoons for that. And at the same time, if a child is unstable enough or sick enough or just happens to have some infectious disorder that requires hospitalization, then we make the transition between here to the hospital seamlessly. We provide care in the hospital for our patients, and Lancaster General has been extremely helpful in making services available there and providing a pediatric ward where we can do that care. And again, that's been one of the basic philosophies of the clinic, that the best way to provide care for these children is to make the transition between diagnosis, general care, and specialty care seamless. And so we try to do that. And we try to do it 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Now, three of us take call. Kevin and I are the pediatricians. Donna takes call as a nurse practitioner, but needs us to back her up so that, you know, the call schedule gets pretty heavy, particularly during the winter. Eric is here every day, and Roy is here every day now. And when we see a patient with maple syrup disease who comes through the door for a clinic visit, we draw blood as they come through the door, give it to Eric, and by the time we're finished seeing that patient on the outpatient basis, Eric gives us the amino acid results, and we can make adjustments in their diet. We can tell what their levels are. We can use that biochemical data to make a decision about whether we need to admit that child for in-hospital care.
And to your knowledge, is there any other place on the planet where that can be done?
To my knowledge, there's not. That's an exceptional service, but it's also a reasonable service. And when I first came to Lancaster County, there were a fairly large number of children floating around the community with maple syrup disease who from time to time would get sick enough that they would become unstable, and they would go to their family practitioner or pediatrician who might draw a blood sample and send it off to Philadelphia, and that sample would come back 3 weeks later with a bill of $450. Now, this is like sending a blood sugar on a diabetic and waiting 3 weeks to decide whether you're going to adjust the insulin or not. It was an absurd approach to treating a disease that's quite volatile. And what I did when I came out here was say, well, what do we have to do to improve that? And one of the obvious things was to be able to do this work in the lab. And interestingly enough, I first managed these children using paper chromatography, which costs you about 5 cents to run a sample. It takes about an hour to run it, and you can actually make pretty good judgments from the anhydrin staining of amino acids on a paper about where their control is. The analyzer we have is much more sophisticated now and gives you much more accurate results, but there were many practical solutions to this problem that just hadn't developed because nobody was committed to doing that. And so, again, the clinic operates on that principle. So when we see children with glutaric aciduria, we look at their blood and urine levels. It takes a little longer to do that. When we see a child who we suspect has a genetic disorder, we can do a PCR-based sequencing assay in 2 or 3 days. So the afternoons, we are seeing a variety of children, some of whom are well, some of whom are sick, who have any one of 83 different genetic disorders that make up our patient population now, and we take care of them as patients.
Well, now you've very helpfully circled back to glutaric aciduria and maple syrup disease, which is where it all began, so to speak, and that allows me to ask what I consider to be the question that we've been leading up to all along. And that is, this clinic is really renowned worldwide as being one of the really leading examples of the advantages of taking a genetic analysis approach to disease. And it is offers a promise for genomic medicine in general. And so what I want to really ask you is, how does your experience with these diseases that you've been able to influence significantly, how does that relate to the general promise of genomic medicine, and how does your work help realize that promise? What is the promise of genomic medicine?
Well, I think at the fundamental level, the most important thing that we do is sort of focus on the effect of the genetic disorder upon the life of the individual patient and figure out what we can do to influence the natural history to prevent the disastrous illnesses that often leave these children disabled. And that has been a focus. So how does molecular biology and biochemical genetics allow us to do that? In large part, our major advantage in understanding these diseases is that we do provide a full range of services for the patient. So we understand how ear infections and vomiting and diarrhea affect the biochemical stability of glutaric aciduria and maple syrup disease, and we've developed treatment strategies to try to intervene to prevent the disastrous illnesses. And with maple syrup disease, you are essentially intervening in a way that prevents prolonged protein catabolism in the patient, which results in biochemical intoxication and ultimately leads to death from cerebral edema and coma in children with maple syrup disease. So we've learned to sort of understand the endocrinologic and biochemical basis of the response to illness in the face of this underlying genetic disorder, and understand many of the effects that that disorder and the intoxication has upon the nervous system, and control the progression of that in a way that allows the patient to survive that illness and even recover and go back to baseline. And it's true for glutaric aciduria and maple syrup disease and medium chain deficiency and a host of other disorders that the interaction between common illnesses and underlying biochemical disorders is essential to understand if you're going to develop effective therapies. Now, beyond that, we do find new genetic disorders, and sometimes we find mutations that cause things like adrenal insufficiency, and we simply know enough from the natural history of that problem to say that this child most likely has a mutation in one of the genes that's involved in synthesizing cortisol or aldosterone. And then we can go to the NCBI database, which is the database in Washington that has been generated by the Human Genome Project, and we can search through that database and find not only the medical information about different adrenal insufficiency syndromes, but we can pull up the exact structure of the gene for 3-beta-oldehydrogenase. And then once we know that structure, once we pull that structure up on the computer, then Eric can sit down and order the primers that allow you to sequence that gene, and then you do the sequencing and look for a mutation that would disrupt synthesis of those compounds in the adrenal. And that's another example of a disorder that results in catastrophic illnesses and death in children if it's not diagnosed. And once we know the mutation is in the population, then we can use that information to test early, to even do newborn screening to look for those diseases within our patient population. And then once we know the disorder is there, we develop ways to intervene.
But your analysis always starts with the patient.
That's right.
And the message I'm getting from your comments about the promise of genomic medicine is that genomic medicine, certainly as practiced here, and I extrapolate as it's going to be practiced in the future, still revolves around the patient. That the genomic medicine insight is one more insight and understanding of how to diagnose and how to treat the patient. But it's still just one aspect of total patient care. Doctors are still going to have to be doctors. There is not going to be a magic bullet that you simply point towards the patient and go zap. That's it.
Yeah, that's right. I gave a talk the other night at F&M to the students there about
Franklin and Marshall College, where you are an adjunct professor.
Sure. And the talk was about the approach to discovering the genetic cause of a disorder in the face of complexity, and why we have such an advantage in causing these specific, in finding the specific causes, and in understanding the natural history of the disease. And the example was looking for vitamin K deficiency, which has caused some notorious cases in this population where children show up with vitamin K deficiency and bleeding often into the central nervous system. And I explained to the students, if you started off with the hypothesis that vitamin K deficiency was a genetic disorder and began to look at that, in the general population you would never find a cause, because it's a very complex disorder that arises from many different disruptions of bile salt circulation and metabolism, many different hepatic disorders. And in fact, in this population we see about six different causes of liver dysfunction that lead to vitamin K deficiency as a presentation. And what we've been able to do is go into that complexity, take small groups of patients, ask the question where these patients are similar to each other, and find the gene mutation that in their particular case puts them at risk for vitamin K deficiency. And what we find is our original hypothesis, which was there was a simple cause, a single cause of vitamin K deficiency, resolves into now five or six different possibilities that we have to be diagnostically sensitive to, and that we can provide a specific answer for why would this child be at risk. Now, what's important about that is that these causes of vitamin K deficiency in the Amish are the same causes of vitamin K deficiency found in the general population of the United States and Europe, because the people of Lancaster County came from Europe not very long ago in genetic terms. They will have different mutations. Children in Kentucky who aren't of Amish descent will have different mutations that cause their vitamin K deficiency. But nonetheless, those diseases can be recognized and treated, and can be misdiagnosed as child abuse just as easily in Kentucky as they were in Lancaster County. So, in part, we're trying to solve local problems and get to the specific cause of a medical problem. And what we find is that many medical problems like vitamin K deficiency and seizure and autism and mental retardation and cerebral palsy resolve into large collections of genetic causes that we can diagnose, we can learn more about, we can develop specific interventions for that are relevant not only to our patients but to patients all around the United States and all around the world. And I think that in a sense is the promise of genomic medicine, that it takes you to a level of understanding of a disease, a capability of diagnosing that disease, and then it gives you insights that allow you to intervene in problems like vitamin K deficiency very simply, very elegantly, and with complete understanding of what you're doing and why you have to look for that problem.
It also reinforces the message that we're all very much the same under the skin.
Yeah, I think it's very important. And, you know, there are many misunderstandings of this population, but one is that these are somehow just Amish problems. Well, glutaric aciduria, which, you know, is considered to be a rare disease in the rest of the world, if we went to a town of 100,000 people and tested for carriers of glutaric aciduria, we would find 1,000 carriers. The carrier frequency for a disease that has the disease incidence of 1 in 40,000 is 1 in 100 people. So if you test in a small town in Pennsylvania, 100,000 people, you will find 1,000 carriers for that disease, and 1/4 of those carriers will have the same gene mutation that causes glutaric aciduria in the Amish.
They're just not marrying each other as often, I guess.
Well, the risk is lower because overall the carrier frequency in the general population is somewhat lower for glutaric aciduria. But, for example, there are other diseases where it's the reverse, where we don't see cystic fibrosis in the Amish of Lancaster County. The carrier rate is zero. In the general population, the carrier rate is 1 in 25. So if you go through and look at the most common 5 disorders that are screened for in Pennsylvania with newborn screening, and you test 100,000 children from the general population and 100,000 children from the Amish population, there are 106 affected children in the general population and 26 of those diseases in the Amish population. So what you realize, one, is that the genes that cause trouble in the Amish came from Europe. They're still circulated in Europe and the United States. They cause significant disease in the general population. Some genes became more common in Lancaster County, but some disappeared. So overall, when you look at the comparison between the disease incidence of old European diseases and the Amish population, yes, there are a few more that are more common, but there's some that are absent. And then you go to the general population, and there are several diseases that are very common in the general population that are absent from this population. And it is an important point that, you know, what we're learning out here doesn't have to do with just the Amish children, but really is relevant to the care of children with these diseases and adults with these diseases throughout the world. These are old mutations that came from Europe just a short time ago and still are found and misbehave in the general population.
Well, you know, in the interest of time, I'm going to wind up this interview, but I've been with you often enough to know that we could go on all day long and you would have many, many more words of wisdom and insight to give us. So at this point, I'll just say maybe we can do this again sometime. And thank you again for being with us.
Thanks very much. Yeah.